look at our top stories this hour. Tensions between Russia and Europe over Ukraine take a new turn, with France saying it has decided to expel dozens of Russian diplomats. A new study shows Americans living in poorer counties across the U.S. died at almost twice the rate of those in richer counties during the coronavirus pandemic. Also ahead, North Korea warns the South that it will attack Seoul if the latter chooses military confrontation or makes a preemptive strike on Pyongyang. Thank you for joining us. It's day 41 of the Russian military offensive against Ukraine, and here's a quick rundown of the main theater of war. The White House claims that Russia is shoring up its campaign in eastern Ukraine with probable plans to deploy tens of thousands of soldiers there. The U.S. says Russian forces are pulling away from Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, in a shift toward the eastern regions. Ukrainian officials also say Russia is preparing for a big attack in the east and have urged mass evacuations in that region. Moscow says its drawdown near Kyiv and the northern city of Chernihiv is a goodwill gesture to support peace talks. Ukraine and its allies say Russia was forced to shift its focus to eastern Ukraine after suffering heavy losses near Kyiv. In the south, heavy fighting reportedly continues around the besieged city of Mariupol as Russian forces try to take the city. The International Committee of the Red Cross says its team has not been able to reach Mariupol to evacuate civilians due to security conditions. That was the fourth attempt in as many days to reach the city. The Russian foreign minister says Western leaders should examine their own conscience before accusing President Vladimir Putin of committing war crimes in Ukraine. Lavrov's remarks came after earlier on Monday U.S. President Joe Biden called for his Russian counterpart to be tried for what he called committing war crimes in the Ukrainian town of Bucha. Asked about Biden's comments, Lavrov said the West should first consider its own actions in Iraq and Libya. He said, quote, not all is well with the conscience of American politicians. Separately, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Washington will consult with its allies about Russia's accountability. Sullivan said the case of alleged incidents in Bucha could be referred to the International Criminal Court. Kyiv claims the recently found mass graves in Bucha and other areas near the capital contain bodies of hundreds of civilians executed by Russian troops. Moscow points the accusing finger at Ukraine, saying it has fabricated images of dead civilians to smear the image of Russia. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the Western country's accusation that Russia has committed war crimes in Ukraine is in line with their attempts to create a propaganda campaign against Moscow.
They're interested in psychological warfare and propaganda. That's why the British have held up any inquiry into this incident at the United Nations Security Council, most likely because the British know that they'll be found out to having been involved. The British were instrumental in the White Helmet theatrical operations in Syria, where they would pretend that individuals were wounded or killed, and they were found to be crisis actors. So the British are very well aware that they are most likely going to be exposed as creating this propaganda. They've already been exposed as having Polish film crews hiring actors to pretend that there's all sorts of chaos. And, of course, the United States is desperate to try and provoke some sort of international outrage against Russia. So it is no doubt that this is completely fabricated, dramatic, and it fits the perfect model that NATO has always pursued. They did this in Libya as well when they invented a city in Qatar and pretended that it was Tripoli and did filming of operations there, pretending it was in Libya when it was not. They've also filmed fake beheadings in studios with cameras and studio lights, pretending that it was done in the desert in Libya when it was not.
And tensions between Russia and Europe over Ukraine take a new turn as France says it has decided to expel dozens of Russian diplomats. A French diplomatic source says the country will expel 35 Russian personnel with diplomatic status. The French foreign ministry also said the activities of Russian diplomats were considered contrary to security interests of Paris. The decision was part of a wider European initiative after Germany announced it expelled 40 Russian diplomats. The German foreign minister described the move as a response to what she called the unbelievable brutality Russia had unleashed in Ukraine. Moscow has denounced Berlin's move, calling it an unfriendly act, which would worsen bilateral ties. The Kremlin has also vowed to respond to Germany's move. Earlier, Lithuania said it expelled the Russian ambassador and would recall its envoy in Moscow. And a new study has shed light on exacerbation of wealth-based healthcare disparities in the U.S. during the coronavirus pandemic. It says poorer counties saw deaths at almost twice the rate of wealthier counties. The research was carried out by Poor People's Campaign, which focuses on income inequality in the U.S. It said the death rate in poorer counties was 5 times higher than richer counties during the U.S.'s fourth coronavirus wave, which was caused by the Delta variant. The report found that many of the 300 counties with the highest death rates and a higher percentage of people of color and an average poverty rate of 45%. The campaign's director called the findings shameful, adding that the neglect of poor people in the U.S. during the pandemic is immoral, shocking, and unjust. The U.S. is the only industrialized nation not providing health services for everybody. Nearly 1 million Americans have died of COVID, more than any other country in the world. Frank Emspach, an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin, is now on the line from Madison. Professor, thank you for joining us. So what's your thoughts here? Either you are white and rich, or you stand a higher chance of dying in the event of a pandemic in the U.S.
Well, 55 years ago today, Martin Luther King spoke at Riverside Church in New York City. He spoke against the war in Vietnam, but that's not the only thing he was talking about. He made the point very, very clearly that we were a nation that was unequal in all respects, and singled out in particular the situation with poor people and people of color, that in every aspect of our society, they were disadvantaged in all kinds of different ways. So that was 55 years ago. And the situation, if anything, in terms of wealth inequality, has only gotten worse. The healthcare is one aspect, longevity is another. The issue of infant mortality is a third. Every single possible social measure has a racial component to it in this country. And generally, the blacker you are, the worse the outcomes. And that has been true now for some time. The Kerner Report in the mid-60s, that was why are people revolting, that was what, and commissioned by the federal government, called for huge investments in social services in this country. And that was simply not done. And each time we've had this discussion, it has been overshadowed by increased spending for war, and there's no difference this time. And I think that each time this happens, we find ourselves, we meaning the average person in the United States, finds themselves in worse and worse shape. Because it isn't just poor people who are being disadvantaged. What's happening now is that the standard of living for all people, except the top 10%, has stagnated. And so what we're seeing now is a real change in this society, increasing inequality, decreasing upward mobility, and a crisis in every single aspect of our society.
Frank, one more thing. When you think of the pompous rhetoric of the U.S. politicians calling the U.S. the land of equality, and then we see these kind of studies being conducted and showing that, as you said, there is this increasing inequality and the standard of living is just decreasing. How do you explain why politicians would be so pompous about the U.S. and about equality?
Well, Well, there is, they want to win the election, and there's a couple of ways to do that in this country, other than being a very, very strong nationalist. One is to blame somebody else for the problems, and generally it's much easier to blame somebody abroad, blame the Russians, blame you guys in Iran, blame the Mexicans, than to blame the people who are really running the country. You know, it's don't bite to a routine. And I think we in this country, in terms of the media or the actual political structure, don't have the kind of opposition that really calls and progressive people in general, or people questioning the status quo, do not have an organizational strength to force a change in the dialogue. And we saw that with the primary defeat of Bernie Sanders, who had a tremendous amount of popular support, but the is currently of the Democratic Party are ones that he opposed, and that many opposed, but were not enough in that sense to force a change. And since Biden has been elected, much better in my view than President Trump, but still fundamentally a very centrist Democrat with a basic war mentality. And I think that that's where we're stuck. And unless we change that, unless we change willingness to change the way in which we apportion wealth, we're going to find ourselves in more and more difficulty in this country.
Thank you so much for joining us, Professor. That was Frank Emsbach, an emeritus professor at the University of Wisconsin, joining us from Madison. Moving on, North Korea fumes over South's missile capability remarks, warning that it will attack Seoul if it chooses military confrontation or makes a preemptive strike on Pyongyang. The warning came from Kim Yo-jung, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. On Friday, South Korea's defense minister said Seoul had accurate missiles, which could, quote, quickly hit any target in North Korea. Kim said it was a very big mistake for the South Korean minister to talk about an attack on the North. However, she added that Pyongyang opposes war and does not view South Korea as its principal enemy. Tensions have been rising on the Korean Peninsula since last month, when the North resumed testing intercontinental ballistic missiles after a five-year pause. The Palestinian Health Ministry says Israeli forces killed over 350 Palestinians in 2021, while injuring more than 16,000 in the same period. The ministry says over 260 Palestinians were killed in the Gaza Strip, mostly during the Israeli war on the enclave last May. The ministry says 90 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank, including the occupied East Al-Quds. Among Palestinians killed last year, nearly 90 were children, 60 were women, and 20 were elderly. Most of the injuries were also recorded in the Gaza Strip during Israel's 11-day aggression in May. Meanwhile, a separate report by the Palestinian Prisoner Society says Israel has detained over 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories since 2015. The society says over 160 Palestinian children are currently doing time in Israeli jails. Tensions in the occupied Palestinian territories have increased dramatically over the past few days. The escalation has coincided with the holy month of Ramadan, and as customary, restrictions to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque have been one of the reasons behind the clashes. In the latest development, Palestinians were attacked as they gathered for night prayers in East Al-Quds.
The holy month of Ramadan has begun for Muslims around the world. However, some struggle to observe it under inhumane conditions. Palestinians are facing a new round of escalations while being subjected to a blockade. The number of Palestinians killed so far this week has reached 10. The Gaza Strip-based Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, and the West Bank-headquartered Palestinian Authority have slammed the Israeli regime over its earlier targeted killing of Palestinian youths. In a statement, Palestinian presidential spokesman Nabil Abu Radeina said the ongoing escalation would blow up the situation in Palestine and the entire region. This came after Israel's occupation forces shot dead three Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin on Saturday, amid the escalation of Israeli violence in the Palestinian territories. Israeli forces assassinated the trio by opening fire on their vehicle near the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank. They later seized the vehicle and the bodies of the three people. Al-Quds Brigades, the military wing of Islamic Jihad, identified the victims as its members. Palestinian resistance groups, Islamic Jihad and Hamas have vowed that such atrocious acts will not go unpunished.
If the Israelis see Ramadan as an opportunity when Palestinians, especially Palestinians who are associated with resistance groups, if they see this as an opportunity for them to be gathered with their families, then they become targets, and their families become targets. So this is unfortunately something for the Israelis. This may be considered an opportunity to be more repressive than usual.
Palestinians were brutally attacked by Israeli regime forces at the Damascus Gate of the occupied Al-Quds on the second night of the holy month of Ramadan as well. It is customary for Israeli forces to exhibit increased levels of violence against Palestinians gathering in the area during the fasting month of Ramadan. At least 20 Palestinians were injured in the clashes and 10 were detained.
Moving on, Iran's foreign minister blames the pause in Vienna talks to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA on Washington's excessive demands. Hossein Amir Abdollahian stressed that Iran will never yield to such U.S. demands. The top Iranian diplomat noted that an agreement over the restoration of the JCPOA is achievable if the White House behaves realistically. He also said the foreign ministry acts with logic and power to observe the country's red lines. Iran has said these red lines pertain to the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington will not abandon the deal again.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Discrimination based on color, race, ethnicity, or religion is repugnant and must not only be condemned but also opposed practically, says Khadija Ali, journalist, in an article titled "Islamophobia, the Last Form of Racism in the World." Stay tuned for more. Discrimination based on color, race, ethnicity, or religion is repugnant and must not only be condemned, but also opposed practically. There are numerous United Nations General Assembly resolutions affirming concrete action against racial or other forms of discrimination. Yet, Islamophobia continues to rage and exacts a heavy toll of innocent Muslims in many parts of the world, including Canada. One particular UNGA resolution proposed that the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination be observed annually. It coincides with the day the white police force in South Africa opened fire and killed 69 blacks in Sharpeville in 1960. They were holding a peaceful demonstration against apartheid passed laws. South Africa was then under apartheid rule. It ended in 1992 and South Africa elected its first black president, Nelson Mandela, in 1994. In 1979, the General Assembly adopted a program of activities to be undertaken during the second half of the decade for action to combat racism and racial discrimination. The UNGA decided that a week of solidarity with the peoples struggling against racism and racial discrimination, beginning on March 21st, would be organized annually in all states. There is even an international convention on the elimination of racial discrimination, but racism in different forms exist. Its most virulent form is Islamophobia, targeting Muslims because of their faith and how they dress. While states have adopted various measures from perfunctory to serious against racial discrimination, Islamophobia continues to grow with deadly consequences. It exists at multiple levels, individual, institutional, and state. Some individuals may harbor prejudices, but it is the state that provides the framework, both through active policies and also lack of policies to confront this menace that leads to its spread. Let us consider the UNGA debate and subsequent adoption of a resolution against Islamophobia on March 15th. Proposed by Pakistan, the resolution was supported by 55 Muslim-majority countries of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, OIC, as well as many other countries in North Africa and Russia and China. It affirmed that March 15th will be marked annually as the UN-recognized International Day to Combat Islamophobia. March 15th marks the anniversary of the 2019 attacks on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, in which 51 Muslim worshippers were murdered in cold blood as they gathered for Friday prayers. It has now emerged that the Christchurch terrorists, originally from Australia, was influenced in part by a pro-Israel Canadian media outlet, Rebel Media, whose owner Ezra Levant promoted Islamophobic troops. Levant tried to silence, unsuccessfully as it turned out, those that exposed his media outlet's influence on the mass murderer. The Christchurch terrorist was no doubt influenced by other racist outlets and individuals, as well as leading him to commit one of the most despicable crimes against innocent Muslims. The UNGA vote on Islamophobia, while welcomed by OIC Secretary General Hassan Brahim Taha, had its opponents as well. Taha said it would consolidate global awareness of the threat of hatred and fanaticism against Muslims. And who opposed the UN-recognized International Day to Combat Islamophobia? France, the European Union, and India spoke against the resolution, but did not oppose its adoption by consensus. Looking a little deeper, it is not surprising why these three entities spoke against the resolution. While Europe, especially France, Germany, and Britain, have led the racists and bigots and have also enacted laws specifically targeting Muslims, India has also come out swinging against its 200 million Muslim citizens. The French representative at the UN, Nicolas Daud-Rivière, took refuge behind the excuse that France supported the protection of all religions and beliefs, but questioned the singling out of a specific religion. He described the resolution as unsatisfying and problematic. What did he fail to explain was, why has the French regime instituted laws that target Muslims only? Further, Paris took the lead in banning the hijab, the Muslim women's head covering. Women can uncover as much as they want, but Muslim women and girls cannot cover. This goes against French secularism, we are told. And what was the Monsieur Daud-Rivière problem with recognizing Islamophobia as a racist ideology? He said, the term Islamophobia has no agreed upon definition in international law, unlike the freedom of religion or conviction. But it's this liberty that France defends, as well as all other public freedoms, such as freedom of expression or conviction. Daud-Rivière need not have indulged in such verbal gymnastics. The regime that he represents is racist to the core. They are unabashedly anti-Muslim. The rest of Europe is little better, as was evident from the opposition of EU representative. The bloc represents 27 European countries, and while it has permanent observer status at the UN, it does not have voting rights. The EU representative said a focus on Islamophobia was an unnecessary duplication after the UN in 2019 adopted August 22nd as an international day commemorating the victims of acts of violence based on religion or belief. The EU's Islamophobic attitude surfaced when its statement said, "We are concerned with the approach of addressing only one religion through a General Assembly initiative." The EU representative could not be oblivious of the fact that, under the rubric of freedom of expression, vulgar cartoons of the Prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, have been published in several European countries. Such acts are meant to humiliate Muslims. Freedom of expression has limits. No other religion or its revered personalities are subjected to such vulgar attacks.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, may God accept your fast. Here is a saying from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, to help us abstain from undesirable acts during the blessed month of Ramadan. A fasting person is in a state of worship, even when asleep in bed, except when backbiting a fellow Muslim.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful. When we look at the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, every word that he said and every action that he did, it was obviously for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But foremost, it was for mankind themselves. So he was trying to do for mankind what Allah wants him to do. So we see that when we look at justice of the commander of the faithful, we can see that he tried to apply it in every way. Even during the 4 years and 6 months of his government, earth has lived its best life ever, where there were no poor people, there were no crimes, everything was just beautiful. But some could not take that. So when we look at Amir al-Mu'mineen and when we look at his words and his work, we can see how he took justice and he took the rights of people seriously. One of the focus points of Amir al-Mu'mineen when it comes to people and advising people and things that he tried to do himself or commanding others to do is to be aware of the poor people. Because obviously society itself, at the end of the day, you can even, if we can divide into two, you can have the people who are well off, those who can provide and have means to provide their, you know, their food and whatever they require, or there are those who are below the line and they cannot provide for their food, provide food for their families and put food on the table. Those what we call poor to a certain extent. Obviously, Islamically, we differentiate between al-faqir and al-miskeen, so they are different. But let's stay with poor. So when it comes to poor, one of the factors Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam tries to highlight when it comes to the rulers and to the people in power, especially in the letter that he wrote to his commander Malik al-Ashri, he says to him, fear God when dealing with the poor or the problem of the poor, because poverty itself is a huge problem that it began with man himself and it will end obviously with the return of the master of the time, may Allah hasten his appearance. So this problem has been and is still continuing where we see a lot of people are in poverty. So the Amir al-Mu'mineen, he highlights the fact that it is a problem, so it needs to be dealt with. And this problem, he says to him, the poor who have none to patronize them, they have no one to turn to. That's the problem with the poor people. The voices are not heard. No one can see them. No one looks at them. Just recently, I was watching a documentary. There's a tiny, small kind of suburb in the heart of Lagos in Nigeria. It's a kind of floating suburb. It has the poorest people on earth who live on water. And they live inside the city itself. And no one even knows that they exist. And we have millions of people like that, where they live amongst us, but they are poor. Because they are poor, their voices are not heard. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, fear Allah and those ones who cannot raise their voices. He's trying to seek justice for the poor. Now, before we continue, let us take a short break and then we continue.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Just before the break, Amir al-Mu'mineen was saying to Malik, beware of the problem of poverty and poor people, because they have no one to fight for them, who are forlorn, indigent, helpless, and are greatly torn in mind. And that is beautiful for Amir al-Mu'mineen to mention. He says a poor person, not only in terms of materials and materialistic stuff, he is deprived, but also mentally he's deprived. Those who are poor, they have mental problems, they have depression, they have suicide thoughts, severe anxiety, they have sadness, they have every list and every trauma that we have in psychology. These people go through it, because that's what poverty does to you, especially if you have a family and you got kids, and you can look at your family and your kids and you can see that they are suffering. That's an issue. That's a big problem. So Amir Amin says, not only they are torn in terms of materialistic matter, but also in terms of mind. A victim of the vicissitude of time. So time is being very hard on those people. And then the Imam says, among them, there are some who do not question their lot in life, and who, notwithstanding their misery, do not go about seeking alms and seeking, you know, help. And that's also another problem, that we have many type of people who have pride in themselves, who they pride themselves to a state where they would rather stay hungry in their houses and die out of hunger rather than go beg or ask people for money and help. Even Allah says, يَحْسَبُهُمُ الْجَهْلُ أَغْنِيَاءَ مِنَ التَّعَفُّفِ, that you would think they are rich and everything because they do not ask. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says, you amongst your society, amongst your community, you would have people, not only they are poor, not only they have mental issues and, you know, they're mentally sick, but also you would have people who cannot ask, who don't have the capacity, they have pride and, you know, as we call it, azatun nafs, they take care of themselves, to the state where they do not ask for help, for alms, for khums, sadaqat, or Islamic taxes. Say, he says, for God's sake, save God their right, for on your rest the responsibility of protecting their interest. At the end of the day, you are the one who is responsible to safeguard their rights, to make sure that their rights are met. So whoever running the system, be it a local government, or be it a state government, or be it the government itself in general, they are the ones who are responsible on making sure that the poor and poverty are eliminated and the poor's right are met. Sometimes in a lot of countries, when we look around, we see people helping one another rather than the country or the system providing for people or providing for the poor. So the Imam alayhi salam, he says, it is your responsibility, not the responsibility of people, to go collect donations and give to the poor and obviously humiliate them. They need to, their honor needs to be preserved. So the government and the state, they are the ones that are required to make sure that those who are poor, that their rights are met. So inshallah, we'll leave it up to here and we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Iranian families celebrated the ancient tradition of Sizdebedar or Nature's Day by spending some quality time outdoors with family. Yusuf Jalali has the story.
It's Nature's Day in Iran, and parks and countrysides are flooded with families who never miss the chance to spend the final day of Nowruz holidays out with their loved ones. The ancient occasion is called Sizdebedar. Over the past 2 years, the festival was called off amid the coronavirus pandemic, and it's the first time in 2 years that Sizdebedar is marked with such a huge crowd.
Because of the coronavirus, people could not go out on Sizdebedar for 2 years in a row. And this year, the majority are vaccinated and green spaces are jam-packed with picnic goers.
We Iranians have grown up with Sizdebedar and we never miss it. Thank God we can safely enjoy this amazing tradition this year with all our family members and relatives.
Sizdebedar means getting rid of number 13. In Persian mythology, 13 is the bad luck number. Now Sizdebedar is believed to chase away the bad luck and bring good vibes.
Today, we cooked special foods like arsh and chicken kebab to eat them for lunch with our family members. We traditionally believe that this day brings bad luck and we must spend it outdoors with joy to get rid of it.
The event is also called the Festival of Nature, and it is an occasion to raise awareness of the need to preserve the environment.
Throughout the history, Iranians have had close relationship with nature, and that's why we have dedicated a special day in our calendar to nature. Before we leave our place here, we clean the environment.
Sizdebedar is the final day of the two-week celebrations of the Persian New Year, known as Nowruz, which marks the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. The tradition has been celebrated for some 3,000 years in Iran, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan, among other communities. Everyone must have missed outdoor gatherings after more than 2 years of COVID restrictions. Now that worries over the pandemic have eased to some extent, Sizdebedar once again reunited Iranians with Mother Nature, with all the good vibes and hope for a world free of the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
With neon lights on the floor and walls, pulsing electronic beats, and a glowing red shuttlecock bouncing back and forth, Malaysian badminton court evokes a sci-fi movie set. Shuttle in the Dark is a badminton hall in the iconic Petronas Twin Towers in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. It was set up in late 2021 by a sport management company to encourage people to take up the racket sport after 2 years of social restrictions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Director of INIC Sport Management says the initial goal was to draw sports fans and players back into action.
Our initial goal was how can we encourage and gain back the interest of people to come back and play. And not only those enthusiasts, but then as well the new people who was not able to or never play badminton before. So that's why we come out with this experience called Shuttle in the Dark.
Playing on a futuristic court presents an unusual challenge for athletes as they have to adjust their eyes to the darkness to fly. Badminton is one of the most popular sports in Malaysia and Asia, with a thriving community in the Southeast Asian community. It has produced some of the world's top-ranked players. ancient Pompeii has a new guardian, Spot, a four-legged robot dog that will inspect the ancient Italian city's streets and tunnels to identify structural issues. The robot, designed by the U.S. firm Boston Dynamics, will patrol Pompeii at nighttime. The robot inspects the smallest of spaces and gathers data for planning interventions to fix safety and structural issues. Equipped with a 360-degree camera, Spot will also protect the city's streets from illegal relic hunters who cause structural damage to the ruins by digging tunnels. Pompeii will also have its own eye in the sky, a Leica BLK-2 flying laser scanner capable of autonomously conducting 3D scans of the ruins, helping Spot carry out its tasks. Safeguarding ancient sites from treasure hunters has always been a problem for every country, especially the ancient ones.
A super rare bird has added a cute member to critically endangered Sumatran rhinos of Indonesia. The newborn calf is the sixth born since intensive efforts to breed the species began in the 1980s. The female calf, which doesn't have a name yet, was given birth to by a rhino named Rosa in a sanctuary. Rosa has suffered 8 miscarriages since 2005 when she was brought in from the wild for a breeding program. Fewer than 80 Sumatran rhinos remain in the world, mainly on the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. Excessive poaching along with other threats has brought the species to the brink of extinction. The cherry blossom or sakura season in the Japanese capital is a magical experience as trees burst into bloom, dousing the streets with stunning shades of pink. This year, people are enjoying the occasion to the fullest as COVID restrictions are no more there. Thousands gathered in central Tokyo wearing masks, taking pictures and posing for selfies among the trees. Cherry flowers reach full bloom on Sunday, 4 days earlier than usual, according to the Japan Meteorological Agency. The age-old tradition of viewing cherry blossoms typically takes place across the country. The flowers are a national obsession. People flock to parks to hold parties and picnics. However, due to the pandemic, authorities have asked people to refrain from eating and drinking outdoors.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Millions of people across the world celebrate Earth Hour, a symbolic Lights Out event that aims to call attention to environmental issues and the necessity of protecting the planet. The annual event encourages people to turn off their non-essential lighting for an hour and take a break from using electronic devices during that period. Earth Hour takes place every year on the last Saturday of March. The theme of this year's event is Shape Our Future and has been celebrated in more than 180 countries, including Greece, France, Thailand, and Iran. The initiative was first introduced in 2007 by the World Wildlife Fund as a grassroots movement for highlighting the collective responsibility of the people towards their environment. An ancient place in Guatemala with special significance for the Mayan culture could be the next entry on the World Heritage List. The historic village known today as the Takalik Abaj Archaeological Park was occupied for 1700 years before it was abandoned and discovered in 1888. It's said to have been home to a pre-Hispanic people. Archaeologists found their way to this mysterious piece of land where they found a series of exotic artifacts and sculptures back in 2008. Guatemala's Minister of Cultural Heritage says this site has a sacred place in the nation's culture.
Tikal Akibat is a sacred place with important links to Guatemala's culture. It's a place that harbors flora and fauna biodiversity and even Mayan spirituality and war is wild. This makes this place highly important within the Mayan culture in Guatemala.
Archaeologists believe the monuments go back to the deep-rooted civilizations of Olmec and Maya in a Central American culture around 400 BC. The government has presented the site to UNESCO, hoping it will be declared a World Heritage Site. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mark Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital, Sofia, on Wednesday. His first destination is the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he'll fly south to Africa and then around the globe to cross the finish line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
Egypt's rich history seems to be a gift that keeps on giving. The country has unveiled some exquisite, newly discovered tombs. The pharaonic tombs were found at the Saqqara archaeological site south of Cairo. The site is a big necropolis of Memphis, an ancient capital of Egypt. The graves belonged to a senior royal official, or rather senior royal officials. Some of the graves are engraved with interesting titles such as Steward of the Royal House and Supervisor of the Garden. The tombs are around 4,000 years old, dating back to the Old Kingdom of Egypt.
Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, is celebrated worldwide by millions of people, including the people in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The region, known for its natural beauty worldwide, turns magical each year during its spring season. To mark nature's revival, the people of Kashmir have dedicated a day to thank the mesmerizing beauty of spring. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt reports.
As the spring season begins in Kashmir, the earth turns lush green and the trees bear colorful blossoms, with the sky visibly blue and waters clear and glossy. After a not-so-harsh winter this year, the people of Kashmir are welcoming the onset of spring. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, marks the beginning of spring and is celebrated on March 21st. New trees are planted while people offer prayers and seek God's help for a prosperous year.
Each year we await this season so that we can plant new trees. The process of their growth gives us hope, and that hope teaches us that God has set a time for everything. We can't fast-track it. We can only do our best efforts.
On the occasion of Nowruz, women in Kashmir prepare unique dishes made from lotus stem and fish. Mehra and her sister have a busy day today. Friends and family are invited to relish the moment.
We have been taught by our mothers and grandmothers to cook these delicacies on the special occasion of Nowruz. It requires lots of dedication, and what matters is that this food brings friends and families together, and a lot of positive energy is exchanged. For us, Nowruz is not just an occasion, but it marks a fresh beginning of love, growth, and prosperity.
On the occasion of Nowruz, the Kashmiri administration often organizes musical festivals to add fervor to the celebrations. People, especially children, visit these musical festivals in large numbers so that the year starts with cheerful memories. This year, scores of tourists have also come to witness Kashmir's spring.
We had heard that Kashmir looks magical, but we witnessed in reality that this land looks fabulous, especially the spring season.
The early arrival of tourists has added a lot of positivity to Kashmir's tourism sector, which has been hit hard by years of political instability and turmoil. Persian culture is deeply rooted in Kashmir, and celebrating Nowruz is a sign of its influence.
Nowruz marks a new beginning, and after suffering decades of political instability and 2 years of the COVID pandemic,
people are only hoping for a return back to a normal life and an everlasting peace. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Turkey inaugurates the world's longest suspension bridge over the Dardanelles Strait. The bridge is more than 2 kilometers long and connects Turkey's European and Asian shores. It cuts travel time between the two locations to just 6 minutes. A consortium of Turkish and South Korean firms began constructing the huge bridge in 2017 with a budget of 2.5 billion euros. 5,000 workers participated in the colossal undertaking. Passenger vehicles must pay a fare of 200 Turkish liras or around $14 to use the bridge.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
For the first time in the history of Pakistan's parliament, the country's parliamentarians chanted death to America as the legislature rejected a no-confidence vote which sought to oust Prime Minister Imran Khan, saying foreign powers are interfering in the country's democratic process. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, under the heading, Reverse Swing, Imran Khan Outsmarts US Regime Change Plotters.